everybody.
This the exercise sheet. You can have a copy. Are to be handed in until today at noon here in the box. You can also give it directly to Guillermo if you want, but otherwise any day you can also hand it in, of course, earlier. And then they will be corrected and then discussed on Wednesdays. So if anybody already wants them, and they are on the net, anybody who wants them. Are there further questions? I guess everybody who cannot come on Tuesdays is not here, so no issues here on this. Okay, so then we continue with basic network theory. And we started with random networks. So we are in chapter 113 on random networks or graphs. Yeah, hello. And we discussed the last time the degree distribution, a central quantity we will have many times. Degree. Pk. And for a completely random graph where you select everything, the interconnection randomly, we saw that Pk is a Poisson distribution, namely Pk equals e to the minus z, or z to the power k divided by k factorial, where z is the coordination number or the average degree. So that is the average. So that is sum over k, k, pk. And so if you look at that as a function of k, that is discrete, of course. K can be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And you plot pk. For k equals 0, that is a finite number, namely 1 here. And then for k equals the first, it starts to... So that depends how large z is. So if z is very large, then it starts to grow, and then it finally goes down. So typically, it is something like that. Here, that is the exponential going down, is k factorial, and then there's some maximum, I guess, which is more or less at the average degree. And but we become a recurrent topic we will have is the properties of non-random graphs, and they may have degree distribution which are very different from the Poisson-like. So a typical example we will always consider repeatedly are so-called scale-free graphs. And they are degree distribution which you find pretty often in real-world graph, which have anything at small k, so this is k equals 0, 1, 2, and so on, pk. There may be anything at small k, but at large k, you have a power law fall off. So pk is proportional to 1 over k alpha for large k. And why is this important? We will discuss that repeatedly. In most processes, we will see the typical fall off is exponential. So if you have any process in nature which has a typical, let's say, time scale, then the long time behavior will be minus t over t, if t is a time scale. Or if you have a process which has a typical length scale, the fall off will be something like minus x over the length scale L. So normally, when you have a typical scale, this scale will lead to an exponential fall off. So quite generally, we will discuss that in the next chapter in more detail, a scale corresponds to an exponential fall off. So if you have a typical degree, you would expect e to the minus k divided by a typical degree k bar. Let's say if k bar is a typical degree. So that is what you would always naively expect. When you have a scale, you get exponential power loss. And a scale-free graph, so this is normally the case only for large case, not for small k, means you don't have a scale. Why don't you have a scale? Because you can write any power law, 1 over k to the alpha, you can write as k some scale, k to the power alpha times 1 over k bar to the power alpha. So you can rescale everything, and you still have the same power law. You cannot rescale an exponential. And so scale-free graphs or scale-field correlation function in nature are very special, because that means that there's no typical scale. It must be, we will discuss it several times, as a self-organized process. So we will go into that in the next and the over next chapter in detail. And here we just discuss just a few very simple properties of scale-free graphs. So typically, as I said, such a power law occurs only for large k, but for theoretical purposes, one often considers scale-free graphs, which are scale-free over all k's. But of course, in nature, that normally doesn't happen. It only occurs for large k. Typical example, for example, is the internet. The internet has a scale, has of course, for finite connectivity. So if you look at the number of internet, or actually the W worldwide net, that is the degree distribution of outgoing links. And if you look at this degree distribution, they're pretty nicely scale-free. And why is this the case? We will discuss at the end of the chapter. There's some reason why this might be the case for large k. So which kind of powers are allowed for scale-free graphs? First, degree distribution must be normalizable. So if I integrate sum over k equals 0 to a large k, let's say, I will call it L, because large k's and small k's on the blackboard are not really distinguishable, limits L to infinity. So that is a normalization of the degree distribution that I can approximate by an integral for large k's. So limit L to infinity, integral from 0 to L, and I have a scale-free degree distribution, so k to the minus alpha dk, and that is of course nothing else than proportional for large k, if I take only the upper bound, to L to the 1 minus alpha, and that is smaller infinity for alpha larger than 1 and infinity for alpha smaller than 1, and logarithmically just for alpha equals 1. So we need the fall off has to be at least 1. But we also would like to have maybe a finite expectation value. So the average degree distribution, k, which is just sum over k equals 0 to L, large L, k, pk, and that is then proportional to some integral k minus alpha dk, which is then going to be L from 2 minus alpha. So what we have, in order to have the average degree, the average degree to be finite, alpha must be larger than 2. So what we need to have is normally that alpha is bigger than 2. And in nature, actually, what one finds very often are values of alpha which are between 2 and 3. So if you look at degree distribution, which are scale invariant for large k, typical degrees alpha are between 2 and 3. So we will come back to this issue very in detail many times. We are still here giving an overview of all the basic graph properties we might have. And so one of the issues, as I said, in graph theory is the characterization of graphs. And for the characterization, we already had seen the clustering coefficient, C, which was measuring whether you have a triangle here close by. So whether you have local triangles, so the probability that two neighbors of a site are connected. The degree distribution, of course, we have discussed about that for the characterization of graphs. But there are many different ways to have other alternative measures. So there are many alternative measures to characterize a graph. And I'll give you now a few more examples. One measure is the spectrum of a graph. And the spectrum of a graph are the eigenvalues of a certain matrix, and this matrix is called the adjacency matrix. So the adjacency matrix A, this is an n cross times n matrix, adjacency called A C. And that is very simple. It is 0 and 1. Aij equals 0 if I and j not connected, and 1 if I and j connected. So it's just giving the links. We make an example. So we have this, 1, 2, 3. Then the adjacency matrix A looks in the following way. There's 0 here because on the sides are not connected with themselves. one is connected with two, and two connected with one. Two is connected with everybody, and three with two, so this is zero here. So that is the adjacency matrix of this graph. Three is connected with two, and two with three, but three is not connected with one, or one not connected with three. So that is just to say the adjacency matrix and the graph are identical, but actually nothing different. This is a graphical representation of a graph, and this is a graph represented as a matrix. It's a one-to-one correspondence. And since it's symmetric, because if we have a non-directed graph, if A is connect, if an I is connected with J, J is also connected with this one, we have a symmetric matrix. It's a real matrix, so we know that we have, for every symmetric matrix, we can calculate the eigenvalues. And this is obviously the eigenvalues then tell me tell us something about the geometry of the graph, because the adjacency matrix and the geometry is obviously identical. So that means you might calculate the eigenvalues, and the collection of eigenvalues is called the graph spectrum. Collection of eigenvalues of A is a graph spectrum. And so, more in detail, you can define the graph spectrum also continuously, P of lambda, where P of lambda identical to 1 over n, so n is always a number of nodes, sum over j delta of lambda minus lambda j, where lambda j, j equals 1 to n, are the eigenvalues, of A. So, the people coming from physics maybe know this is a spectrum, like we always define that in physics many times over again. We have a matrix, like the Hamiltonian matrix, we calculate the eigenvalues, and the spectrum is defined like that. We can graphically represent that, because that is how it's measured experimentally. So, typical spectrum, why do we define it like that? Because in this way, we can you might think, oh, this doesn't really make sense, because let's say we have three eigenvalues, so that means we have three delta function here. So if it's a function of lambda, we plot here rho of lambda, we have three delta functions, one for lambda 1, one for lambda 2, one for lambda 3. But as I said, in graph theory, we are often interested in the thermodynamic limit. So what happens when n going to infinity? So if n going to infinity, this quantity becomes a continuous quantity, so it becomes a continuous spectrum. So in the limits n to infinity, the graph spectrum rho of lambda will be something continuous, because you have an infinite number of delta functions which will be dense. For example, just to remind you, for the people coming from physics, how does the spectrum of the hydrogen atom looks like? Normally we plot it in this way, lambda, so the energy is that then, vertically, and the hydrogen atoms has here the bound states, the Rydberg states, which are very close to zero, and then we have a continuous spectrum for all the scattering states. So that's, for example, the spectrum hydrogen atom. So we have the bound states and the continuous spectrum. So in physics, we normally plot that vertically because lambda then corresponds to the energy of the Hamiltonian. And so this is one possibility to characterize the spectrum. It has been pretty popular, not so popular anymore nowadays, because graph Laplacian, which I will discuss in a short while, is probably more informative. But there's one famous result, which I will just discuss, and that is the so-called semicircle law. And that is the following result. I will not give the derivation here, that the graph spectrum rho of lambda for an Erdős Rényi graph, for a completely random graph, is an ellipse. It's a very simple ellipse. It's a function of lambda in the thermodynamic limit for Erdős Rényi and going to infinity. And the ellipse looks in the following way. Rho of lambda equals 4z minus lambda squared divided by normalization 1 over 2 pi z. For inside the ellipse and 0 outside. So inside the ellipse, if you look here, the boundary is that so rho of lambda is larger than zero for 2 square root of z bigger than modulus of lambda. So these are here minus 2 square root of z. Z is the coordination number. And here this is 2 square root of z. So this is called the semicircle law. And so that means you know how a random graph looks like, the graph spectrum. And now you have a very big graph with thousands of nodes. And it's very difficult to get a feeling, is this a random graph? Is it very different? You cannot just look at this optically. So what you can do is you can just write up the adjacency matrix, which is very simple to write up, and calculate the spectrum, which is also simple. You just put it into a subroutine which diagonalizes your matrix, a package which you have. And then you plot the graph spectrum. And let's say you find something like that for your graph you have. And then you see, oh, this means my graph cannot be completely random because it has a spectrum which is very different from a completely random graph. And so by comparing the graph spectrum to some spectrum of graphs you know, you can get a feeling what kind of graph I'm having. Because if you have a very large graph, it's very difficult to see what kind of general property does it have. Because you just see a mass of edges and vertices. And so that is why things like the graph spectrum are very useful. But actually, instead of the graph spectrum, most people nowadays use the graph Laplacian, I will tell you in a short moment, which is also a spectrum. It's also a spectrum, but not the spectrum of the adjacency matrix, but of something very closely related to the adjacency matrix. And we will discuss that in a short while. Before we do that, One more remark on the adjacency matrix, because the adjacency matrix is also useful for other purposes, which is clear since the adjacency matrix and the graph are identical. I mean, the adjacency matrix is the graph. So that means all graph properties you can calculate from the adjacency matrix. And just to give another example, we discuss here the connection between the adjacency matrix and the clustering coefficient. By the way, since we are here doing, quite a few people are here from the computational science course, there are different ways to store a graph. The adjacency matrix is one way to store in your computer the graph, the simplest way. You just write down the n cross n, n times n matrix. But of course, for a very large graph, let's say with a million of nodes, this is very space-consuming. Then you have a million times million, you have plenty of entries, and most of them are zero. So normally, in your computer program, you would not store the graph like that, but you would generate an object, a class corresponding to a node having as an entry the index and the collection of neighbors. So normally you would store a graph differently by defining a class for nodes, and every node has is defined by a collection of neighbors. Because for very large graphs, most of the entries of the adjacency matrix are anyhow zero. So this is the most primitive way to store a graph. But normally we would not do it like that. Yeah, so the adjacency matrix is the graph, so you can calculate everything. As an example, the clustering coefficient. And many other things. So the clustering coefficient for large n, this is not really true for small n, but for large n, the clustering coefficient C corresponds to the number of triangles. So C times n divided by 3, C minus 1 divided by 2, explained it now, is identical for large n on the average, identical to the number of triangles. I will explain it now shortly, and you can show that this is corresponds to 1 over 6 of the adjacency matrix multiplied with itself, I1, I2, I3, I4, I5, I6, I3, I1, 1, 2, 4, 3, sorry, not 6. I3, I1, which is 1 over 6, the trace of A cubed. So let me explain that. So the clustering coefficient measures that here. The number of triangles in the following way. For example, you look at this node, and then you look, it had three neighbors, how many of his neighbors are connected. So this is, of course, an average consideration, because not all z is a coordination number, but the degree of every neighbor is, of course, not the coordination number, but only on the average. So how many neighbors do you have? pairs of neighbors do you have for every node? For every node, this is the number of pairs of neighbors you have, z times z minus 1 half. Z gives the probability that they are connected. So z times this quantity, so maybe I should write it like this one here, is the average number of triangles per node. So I have then to multiply it by n to get the overall and divide it by 3, because every triangle is connected to 3 nodes, so I'm overcounting by a factor of 3. So on the average, this is the number of triangles in the system. So triangles, just 3 vertices connected. And now, when are vertices connected? Vertices are connected if there is an entry in the adjacency matrix. So it means if I multiply the adjacency matrix 3 times, I'm going from here to here to here to here. If I want to go from here to here, I have to take the adjacency matrix, has an entry here, has to have an entry here and here. So I have to multiply the adjacency matrix. And I have to close that. So the index I1 is the same index here, because I'm going back to the same side. So this is side. I'm going over all possible sides. So let's see, for example, this is side 1, 2, 3. Then I have to have an entry here, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 1. All these entries of the adjacency matrix have to be non-zero, and I get them by multiplying them and summing over all indices. And then I'm overcounting by a factor of 6, essentially because you have 6 possibilities to do that. Let me make here an example. Let's take the following adjacency matrix, this one here. Then the adjacency matrix is this one. And let's see whether we get here the correct result. So we multiply this adjacency matrix 3 times. So we do now, just to give you an example, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. And I multiply that 3 times. 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. And I take the trace of that. 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. So if I multiply these two, I get here 2. By multiplying this one, I get 1, 1, and I get 1, 2, 1, 1, 1, 2. And I have to multiply it by this one, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0. And I continue here. I get another 2 here, and here I get actually a 3, 3. So I get 3, 2, 3. 3, 3, 2. So on the diagonals, there's always a 2. And if I take the trace is 6. I divide it by 6, and so I get 1, because I have one triangle. In my system. So it's pretty trivial here. Complicated way to calculate that I have one triangle, but I can of course do that for a larger graph. And you see why this is the case, because they have to be connected, and the entry of the adjacency matrix has to be different from 0. So there are many things you can do with this adjacency matrix. As I said, this is a trivial statement, because the adjacency matrix and the graph are identical. So another quantity you can calculate in generally are the moments, and the moments are directly the moments of the graph spectrum. moments of the spectra. So, the moments of the spectra is defined in the following way. ML is defined as d lambda, lambda to the L rho of lambda. This is a very general definition. That is always the case, not only for graph spectrum. Any distribution function that is defined the moment of a distribution function as a general definition for mathematics. It has nothing to do with graph theory. If you put here my definition that the graph spectrum rho of lambda equals 1 over n sum over j delta lambda minus lambda j, so the sum over delta function of the eigenvalues of the adjacency matrix. So then if you take the integral over lambda, you get just the sum over j. So this is in nothing else than 1 over n sum over j equals 1 to n over all the eigenvalues lambda j to the power l, which is a trivial statement. It's always the case. And that is, of course, nothing else than 1 over n, the trace of a to the power l. Why? Because you may know that from theory, the trace of the matrix is the sum over the eigenvalues, because the trace is invariant under an orthogonal transformation. The trace of a matrix is always the same as the sum over the eigenvalues. And now these are the eigenvalues to the power L. So this is the matrix A to the L has the eigenvalues Aj to the power L. Oh, is that clear? And so that means I can calculate the moment of the distribution very simple by calculating the trace. This is actually always the case. You can calculate the moment of the spectrum of any Hamiltonian in this way. So if you take a Hamiltonian and you want to calculate the spectrum of the Hamiltonian and the moments of the spectral weight, then you just do it like that. So this has nothing to do with graph theory. This is just basic mathematics. And by the way, this means that the clustering coefficient is essentially equivalent to the third moment. Since this is a trace to a to the 3, well, there's a factor of 6, but apart from the factor of 6, the clustering coefficient corresponds to the to the third moment of the adjacency matrix of the graph spectrum. So now we're coming to the graph Laplacian, and the graph Laplacian, do the definition, is a very interesting quantity because it allows to make direct contact with all kind of dynamical and physical processes happening on the graph. That is clear because we know that the Laplace operator is a very important operator in physics, describing many things, the Laplace is. From the wave equation and many other things. So the issue is the Laplace. So how do you define differential operators? So enter operate those on graphs. So let's go back to another, let's say we have a normal function in one dimension. So we have a one-dimensional function, f of x, which is something, and we take the derivative, which is the differential operator, so dx often, or which is d by dx. So d by dx of f is defined as limit delta x to 0, f of x plus delta x minus f of x divided by delta x. And so if we want to generalize a differential equation operator on a graph, we will have to take this form, where then x and x plus delta x are two different vertices on the graph. So this is normal, and what we want to have is a graph, side 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and we have a function f of xi equals f of I, and I equals 1 to n are the vertices of the graph. So on every vertex, I have a function which has some value. But of course, it is discrete by space because my values are only the vertices. So for example, for a neuron, you can have the firing rate. For a web page, it can be the number of links or the activity. For a gene, the activity. So every node of your graph has a certain function which is there. So this is for the first derivative. So what about the Laplacian? So the second derivative. The second derivative, f2 prime, we can define as two differences. And two differences is nothing than f of x plus delta x plus f of x minus delta x minus 2 times f of x divided by delta x squared. That is the second derivative in the Riemann representation, just taking two first derivative and dividing by another delta x. Is that clear? Or maybe I'll just do that. Maybe I'll just do that. So if I take two derivatives, so I take f prime of x minus f prime of x minus delta x divided by delta x, which is nothing than d by dx of d by dx of f, because I take the derivative of 2. And then you see this is identical. this is the first part here, and here I just make a shift, so I get another f of x let's just do that. That is 1 over delta x squared f of x plus delta x minus f of x minus f of x, which is this one here, minus f of x minus delta x. And then you see this is identical to above. So that is the definition of a discrete Laplacian. Because, of course, you would say, why Laplacian? Because the Laplace operator is d by dx squared plus d by dy squared plus d by dz squared. But now, so that is the Laplace operator. the sum over second derivatives. But of course, now for the graph Laplacian, we will have all neighbors being involved. So there will be not just the sum over delta x in one direction or here, but over all neighbors. So the Laplacian is defined in the following way. Or we define it as a big lambda. So that is a lambda, Greek lambda. And lambda ij, the element of the graph Laplacian, equals sum over j, aij, delta ij minus ii minus j. It's more complicated, it looks more complicated than it is. It's really something very simple. It is ki if I equals j minus 1 if I j connected and 0 otherwise. So,
yeah? J. Okay, but on the left side you also have J, so you count sum over J on the right side.
So you say, yeah, I have a bad notation, I should move quickly in L. Yeah. There's a bad notation in that. Yeah. So it's actually very physical. You see, there's apart from a minus sign, you see, on side, on the same side, you have minus 2. This is actually Laplacian apart from a minus sign. So this is the number of neighbors you have. Because if you add x squared, y squared here, so if you add these three, then you get f of x plus delta x, you get an f of x plus delta y, f of x plus delta z, because of, if you add it with all three, you get minus two for all three components, you would get in total minus 6. Because this is the total number of neighbors you have on a hypercubic lattice, 6 neighbors. And this is what you have here, ki, the total number of neighbors. In all other directions, so on the off-diagonal side, you get 1. So this is, of course, minus 1 plus 1, but apart from a minus sign, this is exactly the generalization of this quantity to a graph. So there's no, this is just a direct generalization. That means, if your lattice is, let's say, a two-dimensional lattice, which can happen, let's say your graph is a two-dimensional lattice, which could happen, then your graph Laplacian is exactly the normal Laplacian. Thus, discretized on your two-dimensional lattice. So this is the most straightforward and most meaningful generalization of the Laplacian to a graph. And you see, it is different from the eigenvalues. Or if you calculate the eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix, because the adjacency matrix has only this component and doesn't have this onside component, which depends on the degree of every vertex. But it's a very physical quantity, and I will discuss it then on Thursday.